You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's a grim and miserable day outside, so hopefully we will be nice and toasty in here. Good afternoon, welcome to today's afternoon lunchtime, special lunchtime event. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Research and Innovation here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you to today's discussion. We're looking at the challenges facing the recovery sector at the moment. Last year, over 300,000 people in England entered treatment for drug and alcohol misuse, and substance misuse damages individuals, families, communities, and places a heavy burden on public services. Health services, as we know, are currently facing significant challenges with looming budget cuts and pressure to demonstrate outcomes. Evidence suggests that recovery from substance misuse extends much further than the reach of the treatment organisation. So we've been having an interesting conversation about social networks with the panel that I hope to reprise later. Is it time to radically rethink the notion of treatment? At the RSA, we've been working with CRI to explore whole person recovery in a research project that we've been doing. It's exploring an innovative kind of person-centred approach to recovery based on the belief that lasting recovery requires an equal partnership between professionals and those in recovery, as well as involvement of the wider community to help them sustain what we term recovery capital in the longer term. But how do we take this longer term approach given our current critical financial situation? Is it possible to build more creative, holistic, sustainable approaches to recovery in a cold funding climate? And that's the substance of our conversation that we're going to have today. Indeed, is it in fact necessary to change things? We've brought together an expert panel to help us begin to address some of these questions. Alice Evans, Director of Systems Change at Llanquilly Chase, was going to join us, and I will talk to some of the key points that she said, although probably not as eloquently as that she had planned to do herself. Mark Moody is the Executive Director for Health and Social Care for CRI. Mark has worked in social care for 20 years and joined CRI as a frontline worker in 2000. He's held positions at every level of the organisation prior to becoming a director in 2007, and his remit covers approximately 160 client services across England. David Best is Director of Criminology at Sheffield Hallam University and Associate Professor of Addiction Studies at Monash University in Melbourne. A qualified criminologist and psychologist, David has held a number of university posts, including that at the LSE and Institute of Psychiatry, and has held research policy roles at the Police Complaints Authority and National Treatment Agency for Substance Misuse. He's the author of more than 150 peer-reviewed journal papers and a number of books on addiction recovery, as well as an RSA report on recovery capital. David's main area of interest is around pathways to recovery and the role of social networks in promoting well-being, and he has a huge repository of data that we're going to try and pick out at some point during this conversation. Sunny Dadley is the manager of the multi-award-winning peer-led substance misuse service in the West Midlands called Suit, I hope. And is the current CMI Regional Chartered Manager of the Year. His approach to collaborative person-centred working is changing the way that those affected by addiction are able to unlock their individual potential and contribute positively to themselves and society. Please join me in welcoming our panel. Thank you. So before we begin and I move on to Mark, I am going to try and summarise what Alice was going to bring to the table. So I'm not role-playing, but I will be reading to some of the key points that she had shared. We invited Llanquilly Chase to join this panel because they are an independent charitable foundation that has really focused in the last 2 years on individuals and people who face severe and multiple disadvantage. So I will pull out from her speech. She wanted to give the kind of landscape specifically about what the background to multiple and complex needs and how to design projects to address these specific challenges, especially in this changing financial climate. So, on Alice's behalf, when Llanquilly Chase discussed severe and multiple disadvantage, people often hear it as multiple needs and relating to homelessness, drug and alcohol dependencies, mental health challenges, and contact with the criminal justice system. But this is only one part of the picture. People experience and respond to trauma, structural poverty, racism, and gender inequality differently. And for that reason, Llanquilly Chase likes to take a broader approach to what they mean by multiple disadvantage, including things like extreme poverty and abuse. If you start from the individual's view, people rarely experience this problem in isolation. And this is why we wanted to refer to the Lankelly Chase work, because it sets a context for all of the pieces of work that we're going to talk about later in this session. When you experience multiple disadvantages, your challenges exponentially multiply. A report that Lankelly Chase brought out earlier this year showed that complexity really results in individuals' lives. But in trying to respond to complexity, we've tried to make things neat and simple. We've defined each individual disadvantage as a discrete issue, created different funding streams, which in turn encourage the emergence of different sectors to respond to those needs, which in turn create their own cultures, languages, and frameworks. So we're creating an incredibly complex environment to respond to an individual need. Through a systemic response, we've created separate sectors who each believe they are responding to the whole person. Instead of breaking down the walls between these different sectors, we try to teach people to navigate the sectors, and when people struggle to navigate the systems, they are then seen as hard to reach. What people tell us they actually want and need is quite simple: a consistent relationship with someone who properly listens and is able to respond to what they are saying, not offer what that organisation has, someone who sees them as a person, not as a series of negative and problematising labels to be resolved. So I think that sets a nice context for actually how people engage with services and how we might need to think differently about services and service provision in the future. So I'm now going to pass over to Mark Moody to talk about the development of the recovery agenda and the work that we've been doing with CRI a little bit on the whole person recovery project and challenges ahead for the recovery sector. So Mark, over to you.
Thank you. When I got this brief, I decided maybe the best way to describe the development of the recovery agenda is my own experience of how it developed. For a number of years, I worked in London for CRI, and I was responsible for running perfectly good treatment services for people with drug and alcohol problems. In fact, I've met a couple of people today who came through those services and have done just fine, and that's lovely. They were perfectly good treatment services, and sometimes people got better. And generally speaking, actually, at that point, I noticed that generally speaking, the people who got better were people who had other things around them. So we did the clinical interventions, a bit of psychosocial, all that good stuff, helped them through the critical phase, and they moved on. Perhaps we didn't do much to build other things around them. We put them out into the world, drug and alcohol free, and the people who had stuff around them did well. About 6 years ago, I went to the north of England to work for CRI. The northwest specifically, and I visited some places in Merseyside, which I think David is familiar with, that sort of blew my mind and made me feel like an idiot. Because what was happening there was we were running perfectly good treatment services. Again, we had doctors and nurses and governance, and we did everything just so, by the Orange Book and so forth. But alongside that, it was very evident that the people who were accessing our services were being treated as an entire human being who had some issues in their life that they wanted to overcome, rather than as a problem with legs. So the fact that they had a substance misuse issue was, of course, the acute reason for them to come to us. But actually, our services, perhaps despite policy, and maybe despite CRI's policies, actually, our services had responded to the whole person. They were looking at the whole thing. And actually, other than those highly regulated, very professionalised interventions, an awful lot of the rest of the stuff that people were doing in some of those services was about, what are you going to do once you stop doing this? And it led me to a comment that one of my friends made, which got it, was they were talking about recovery not being about the absence of something, it was about the presence of other things. And that, like I say, I felt like an idiot. I've been working in this field for 20 years and I saw this stuff and I saw a lot of people getting well, being not just drug and alcohol free, but being happy and doing rewarding things and giving back to other people. I'm not sure, David might know better, why the northwest of England seemed to be the hotbed of this. I think there was some connection to work that had been done in America. I think there were some people in the then NTA who had really got a grip of the things. And now, in that part of the country, the workforce is culturally in the place to, of course, still deliver the highly regulated and professional stuff, but also do something that's a bit broader, that's more about, and what happens to you when you don't come to us anymore? And most importantly, you don't want to come to us for the rest of your life, do you? You don't want to be self-identifying. The only important thing about you being your previous acute addiction issues. So that was the development for me was that's where I saw it. And I would say that about 5 or 6 years ago is when the stuff that, to be fair to David, has been going on about for a number of years longer than that, started to actually be realised in services. And I can see I'm now responsible across the whole country, so we had another restructure, and I find as you come down the country, the recovery ethos is a little stronger in the north. It's there in the Midlands, have to say that. Right? it is, we've met before. It's there in the Midlands, and as you get down to London, perhaps the services aren't quite as engaged with it. Part of that might be because people in London and the South East just have more opportunities anyway. Maybe it's not been the rock bottom thing that some of those communities in the northwest of England had. So that's all very nice, and it's the kind of thing you might expect someone who comes from a charity to say. It's nice and soft and fluffy, and people getting better is all about other people, but where's the evidence base? And that kind of brings us to the work that we did with the RSA and some other pieces of work that we're doing. It's my feeling that if you only use evidence-based practice, you never have any kind of innovation. There are things where evidence-based practice is incredibly important, and obviously your Orange Book guidelines and all these things around clinical intervention and so forth, they need to be done just so. But if you only do what people have done before, nothing changes. And actually, every great advance in humanity is about someone doing something that didn't have an evidence base because they had a hunch. What working with RSA is about is actually looking at practice-based evidence, looking at whether the hunch that the RSA and ourselves and David share, and seeing if we can prove to people that this is actually a better way of doing things that's more effective, gets better outcomes, potentially is cheaper as well, which is, of course, an important thing at the moment. I think read the paper, see what's there, see if you believe it. I know that it's not been made up. I know that this stuff works. I know that it works in other parts of the country too. And it's important to me that we do have solid evidence so that people who think we really are, I don't know, hippies, socks and sandals, I don't know what... looking at me, you wouldn't think it was called those things, but I have been. I want to be able to go back and say, do you know what, we had a hunch, we tested the hunch, and here's the evidence. And I think the work with the RSA is a really big part of that, and some other things that we're doing with RSA and others, I think managed to make the fact that recovery is both possible and that social networks have a huge part to play in that. I want to be able to prove that to people rather than just say I sincerely believe it, because I do sincerely believe it. And then we come to the challenges. And everybody expects to say the challenge is the dreadful government funding cuts, right? Because obviously it's dreadful and government funding cuts. But I like to go strengths-based about this. The cuts are what the cuts are. Would I like to keep the same level of funding? Of course I would, because then I could do more of whatever it was I was going to do. But actually, there's a bit of me that thinks that for the sector, the necessity to look at different ways of doing things might not be all bad. There's a baseline level of funding that I think is required to keep things safe when people are in very acute need. I think you're always going to need doctors and nurses and so forth, and a percentage of people need formal psychosocial interventions and all that. But I think we now have a situation where if we continue to do the same things with less resources, that arithmetic tells you it's going to turn out worse. Right? You don't need to be all that good at sums to work out that the same with less equals worse. I seriously believe that using some of the principles that are in the RSA paper, some of the stuff that Dave is going to talk about, some of the stuff that Sonny's going to talk about, particularly actually, we can not only not do worse with less, I think it is possible that we can do better. I think that this might be the poke that the sector needs. It's a pretty severe one, mind you, and that's the big challenge for me, is that culturally not all of the services across the country are ready to make this shift. I have got some that I'm very happy about where we've been working for years, and culturally they're embedded in their communities, they're using the resources that exist outside of the services. In other places it is going to be a big shock. The transition from what has been a doing things to people treatment service to the doing things with people recovery service is not one that happens overnight, and I think that if the cuts come too quickly and too strongly, some places will really suffer. I think it will it will show that those places that have adopted this approach earlier won't suffer nearly as much, because the resilience of those communities and the abilities of people to support each other, with people like us just providing professional support to recovery communities, it wouldn't be the way I'd want to evidence that it worked by there being disasters anywhere. But I do think that going forward, if things are insensibly, we can do better with less. I really do. And the challenge is making everybody believe that, and particularly the staff that continue to work in the field.
Thank you. So on that kind of provocative point, we'd like to move over to David Best to talk a little bit about the research landscape in the recovery sphere.
Great, thank you very much. So I think it's my job to give you as much principles, theory and evidence as I can cram into 6 minutes, so here goes. Recovery has been a highly kind of contested term since it started, and I guess one of the mental health definitions of recovery has tended to think of four different ways you could conceptualise it. So there's personal recovery, which is subjective experience, clinical recovery, which is the alleviation, amelioration of symptoms, social recovery, which is about how other people see you and how you engage, and functional recovery, which has probably been the most contentious part in the UK, which is about getting on with your life, jobs, work, safe housing, that kind of thing. I think irrespective of where you place your emphasis in that particular model, I think it's important to say that the whole concept of recovery has been fundamentally transformative and challenging and provocative. And I've just made a note of three things that I think, and Mark alluded to several of them, that are fundamentally challenging to the field. So the first one is the transition from a pathology model to a strengths-based model. And this is not unique to recovery, either addiction or mental health, because it's entirely consistent with a whole field of positive criminology, positive psychology, therapeutic jurisprudence. You know, this is a switch in the way we understand how to make things better, not by making a big list of ailments and then trying to tick them off one by one, because it doesn't work and it's not holistic enough. The second, which is a huge challenge to professionals, is the switch from an expert model to a partnership model, which links to the third, which is the switch from the clinic as the locus of solutions to the community as the locus of solutions. And all of these three things are fundamentally challenging. And again, to go back to the mental health field, there's a reason why this is relevant to recovery, and in a lovely analysis, overview analysis of what works in recovery interventions, published in the British Journal of Psychiatry in 2011, Leamy and colleagues used an acronym called CHIME. And CHIME represented the key characteristics of effective recovery interventions. What were they? Connectedness, other people, hope, a positive outlook, identity, no addict identity, but a positive identity, meaning, something to do that's purposeful, and empowerment. Those were the core characteristics of what we know is successful. And it's crucial that as we think this, and one of the other things that I think is important to reiterate that Mark mentioned is that the journey to recovery is a process, not an event. And we know that in the first year, here is hard stats and data, in the first year post-detox, the relapse risk is between 50 and 70%, so well over half. By 5 years, it drops to 15%, at which point it plateaus. Acute services can get you to that clean point. It's recovery services, your family and your community, that see you through that process. And in our own work in recovery capital, we've talked about three component parts. Personal capital, which is things like resilience skills, self-esteem, self-efficacy, coping, communication skills. Embedded within social recovery capital, which is all those crucial things around transitioning from networks that support your drinking or drug use to networks that support your sobriety. And by far the largest global addictions outcome study, that's the single biggest predictor of effective recovery, transitioning your networks. We found it in the UK. In 2008, we published a paper which said the initial ability to stop is about psychological change in events. Sustaining the stopping is about who you know and who you spend time with. So this is crucial. But the third thing, and the thing that I want to add to that discussion, is community recovery capital. And community recovery capital is effectively about not just about the person or their family, it's about all of you and all of society, because it's about, in that 5-year journey, will people allow you to be reintegrated? Or do they have that attitude that says, well, I know they're in recovery, but I don't really believe that. They're still an addict, really, so no contact. Not in my college, not in my university, not in my street, not in my workplace. Because effectively, for us really to make recovery happen, there has to be a social contract and a social justice contract that says we will allow and engage people to change. And from criminology, we know there's a very famous criminology writer called John Braithwaite who argued societies can be split into two groups. The ones who do disintegrative shaming. When somebody has been excluded, they're not allowed back in. That's it. They become marginalised, they become whatever you want to call it, underclass, dispossessed, excluded. Or you can have reintegrative shaming, where you say when people are excluded, they are supported and helped to effectively reintegrate. And that's not about professionals and it's not about the person, because they can only go so far if society won't support them. And we hear professionals in the alcohol and drug field bleating endlessly about journalists using language. Well, we just finished a stigma study where what we found was that among trainee professionals, there is still a huge amount of residual stigmatisation, social distancing, exclusion. So we asked all these questions about would you be willing to go out for a meal with somebody? Would you have them look after your children? Would you have them work beside you? And as was found in America, with active addicts, the answer was no. But with recovering addicts and recovering alcoholics, the answer was still only a very partial yes. And if our potential professionals don't believe that people can really recover, how can we expect the general public to? And one of the massive challenges for a recovery movement is to move from a world where recovery is this kind of anonymous, underground, hidden thing, where people feel that to sustain a recovery journey, they either join anonymous fellowships or they move to Devon and start again, to a world where there's genuinely a therapeutic landscape of recovery and a therapeutic belief that people can change and make those sustainable things. Now, that's not a treatment journey. That's about creating visible, positive icons of recovery. And I think at this point, it's also worth saying, in Australia, where I work a couple of months a year, we've just finished a study where we showed that a quarter of the alcohol and drug workforce in Victoria have worse psychological health than the average client at intake to treatment. The burnout, secondary stigmatisation and exclusion of our workforce itself is a huge problem. And the notion that recovery only applies to the client is misleading. It applies to the client. It applies to their family. But it applies to an awful lot of workers. And one of the points about that five-year journey to recovery is it stops being about drugs, alcohol, crime, disease, and becomes about lifelong concerns about giving back, making a contribution. And that should apply to the workforce we in our field as much as it applies to the clients. It should apply to academics as much as it applies to clients. And that notion of recovery as holistic means holistic in two senses, not just about the person's own life, but all of us together in a joint endeavour. And that's fundamentally the social enterprise challenge. So I'm going to finish by mentioning two really positive projects that I'm involved in. One is a project called Jobs, Friends and Houses in Blackpool. And Blackpool is a highly deprived area. And in Blackpool, in an attempt to create a therapeutic landscape, people coming out of prison or coming out of detox or rehab are invited to start an apprenticeship to physically build the recovery community, to build recovery housing. They do it in a very high-profile, highly visible way. And people are inspired by the idea they're giving back, they're building a recovery community, and they're seen by the community as doing something positive. In the first year of 40 people, there's been one relapse, and there's been no reoffending among the initial cohort of 40. And in our field, that is almost unique. And in the world, Phoenix Futures are doing something very similar around housing pathways. And I guess the point to make is it really is a glass half full, glass half empty question. I've been asked a lot in the year since I came back from Australia, are we doing well or are we not doing well? Well, it seems to me one of the things is there are huge examples of positive practice, hope, innovation, excitement, empowerment, but it's still patchy. And one of the challenges, I think, for all of us is to live our lives in a way that supports and is open to recovery, but also to kind of disseminate and promote innovation and exciting new practice. There is plenty of recovery evidence. It's convincing people who don't want to be convinced that it makes differences not only to a group of people who are excluded, but that the recovery population are a significant bonus and benefit to the communities they live in. And so the idea for supporting recovery is not just to help people get better, it's to make the places we live better places to live. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And we're going to move over to Sunny Dudley now to talk about peer-led approaches and the relationship between peers and commissioners and the rest of the sector.
Cool, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. So back in 2007, I was an active heroin and crack cocaine user. I decided that I wanted to change. I decided that on a number of occasions. But this time I really wanted to change. I approached my local treatment provider, who subsequently told me that there was no funding left for me to detox, which is what I wanted to do. And by hook or by crook, I managed to get what I needed from them, which meant that on the 10th of September 2007, I started a community detox at my parents' house. I finished it on the 20th of September 2007. Got married on the 30th of September 2007, which was also my 27th birthday. Flew to Bali, had a wonderful time, and as soon as I landed in Bali, I had instant gratification. I knew straight away that the decision to kind of change was the right thing to do for me and my future prospects. Landed back in the UK, at which point I thought, well, what do I do with myself? What do I enjoy doing? What do I not enjoy doing? I had an overwhelming desire to help other people. And at that point, the kind of word recovery wasn't really heard of. Peer support wasn't really heard of. But luckily for me, there was a new project that had just been commissioned around service user involvement. It didn't have a name at that point, at which point I went along and I signed up as a volunteer. And that enabled me then to share the message of kind of hope and recovery with lots of different people from the criminal justice world, people serving community orders, and I suppose one thing I must say is that there was nobody directing this, perhaps divinely. There was no person saying to me, well, actually, have you considered going back into education? Have you considered doing, you know, looking at your employment opportunities? So I kind of had to create my own journey, as it were. At the same time as volunteering for this service user organisation, I got some experience within a treatment provider setting. So I was on the other side of things, carrying out triage assessments, running needle exchange programs, etc. To speed things up, within 6 months of volunteering, I became a project worker at this service user involvement project. A month after that, the manager left. I applied for that, and I've been managing an organisation called SUIT for the past 7 years and 2.5 months. And what that's done for me is it's taught me an enormous number of things in lots of different ways. This quite, dare I say, tokenistic service user involvement project at that point had a very limited service level agreement. It said things like get involved in interview panels, get service users feedback, which is good and it's important. I'm not saying that it's not. But then it soon became apparent, especially as I became more knowledgeable at a strategic level, that there were lots of things that were being promised and there was lots of agreements that were being made. But because we were working with people on a grassroots level, on the ground, I became increasingly frustrated as to why these things weren't being panned out at a ground level, why people weren't experiencing the strategic decisions that were being made. So at that point, I thought, well, actually, if people aren't necessarily going to get the help and support that they need from places where they should get it, then why shouldn't we be the people that provide these interventions? I'll bring you right up to speed. So that was, you know, back in 2007, 2008. As we stand today, we're a very small organisation made up of the equivalent of 3 staff and about 5 volunteers at the moment. And I manage a public health contract, which means that we're contracted the same way as many drug and alcohol treatment services are in this country. We're hosted within an infrastructure organisation. which has got nothing to do with drugs and alcohol. But there's somebody to go to in case, you know, we need to run something by them. Policies, procedures and things like that are in place. I believe what started off, you know, has now developed into a way of supporting people that I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from. There's such a wide variety of needs that individuals need. One of the things I took for granted in my early recovery was that I had somewhere to live. I had enough about me to try and look at what I could do with my life moving forward. I had people that were genuinely interested in how I got on with my life. Very soon after kind of becoming professionalised, I noticed that not everybody had that. And not everybody had people that believed in them. Not everyone had somewhere to live or aspirations. So what we decided to do was to take that massive black hole and fill it with practical, emotional, aspirational and other needs based on what the individuals were presenting with. So in 2014-15, our organisation worked with 791 people on 2,043 occasions, delivering 2,622 interventions. But what was really interesting is when we looked at the data from last year, there were 57 different areas of need that people presented with. So these 791 people had a huge range of needs that they wanted wanted to be addressed or weren't sure how to go about addressing them. So the really key important thing for me is that as we're a peer-led organisation, so we're not necessarily professionally trained, or we weren't at the start, we needed to ensure that we were competent and confident in ensuring that we met the full range of needs that individuals presented with. And when I say 57 different areas of need, they range from immigration issues to bereavement to mental health to illiteracy to employability. And we've created our own kind of bespoke way of gathering data, not because it was written into our SLA, but because we genuinely wanted to know what we were doing. If we compare what we do to what's out there in terms of the system, as it were, everything's very prescriptive within the system. You know, the targets are set up in certain ways to achieve certain outcomes. And I'm sure that the driver for that is in the right, coming from the right place. But what that does, for me personally, it directs everyone involved in that system towards achieving these targets that don't necessarily achieve the individual need. And I think that's a fundamental part of what we need to change in terms of effectively supporting people in moving forward. There's lots of silos in terms of what we do, and Mark alluded to it. It would be wonderful if things worked in synchronisation, if housing support worked in synchronisation with Department of Work and Pensions, worked in synchronisation with Drug and Alcohol Treatment Services. The world in which we work does not operate like that. But the organisation that I manage and that I love, has the opportunity to be that binding glue that brings things together. And that's culminated in things like supporting 132 people back into work in the last 4 years. Last year we made 840 educational interventions, 702 housing interventions. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's amazing that I remember these numbers, but I do. But if I reflect now on what happened in my life and the, you know, what all the wonderful things that have happened, being invited to Buckingham Palace, being awarded Chartered Manager of the Year this year, when I look back and when I reflect on what's out there, I think the true test for us is unearthing the potential within all of those people that are out there in need. I think they have the power to unlock change in others, change in themselves. And that has to be done, obviously, on an individual level to begin with. And then hopefully the more times that we do that as society, the more people will get better, the more people will achieve their potential. And I'll just finish on this thing, on this point. In this world in which we live, there's a great deal of social inequality. And I think all of us have the opportunity to positively influence other people's lives. And I think we should take that responsibility very seriously. And until we do so, there will always be people out there who are looked down upon, who cause harm to themselves and society. And I look forward to kind of having future conversations with our panellists and yourselves about how we can go about making this world a better place. Thank you.
Sunny, and thanks to the other panellists for a very a broad range of views and experiences around the recovery movement. I thought it would be sensible, actually, reflecting on the journey. You've given us quite a nice time frame to look back on there, so reflecting back to sort of 2007 or so and where we've come to where we are now. Looking at the journey before we look to the next destination, I think we could quite quickly look at how do we respond to the cuts, how do we respond to the financial or fiscal situation we're in right now. But I think I just want to pause on a few of the golden thread between all of the things that you had brought out. Organising around the user is something that is very common narrative now that you hear in government. And I want to start looking back on some of the things that you've talked about here, recognising that that's very difficult and has been really proven in the journey towards this kind of recovery movement. We have changed, or there's been a real focus on innovation and recovery in that time between 2007 and now. And you pointed out, David, some very interesting points about we've actually quite fundamentally changed the approach, looking at the approach to diagnosis, moving, as you say, from pathology to a strength-based model. That's quite a mind shift in its own way. Then thinking about how we conceive or consider what a service user is, going from this kind of into this more of a partnership relationship in our service user approach. And then actually this delivery model, so how you functionally respond to the needs of the user, going from a clinic to a community approach. Now, all of these things are very innovative and they're very challenging, but in terms of delivery, that can actually mean that those in the position of delivering those services are having to deal and adapt with and understand what that change means for their practice. And so you get huge complexity in the system of people trying to respond to someone else's innovation. So when you were talking about actually you have pockets of practice that are brilliant, but then you also have pockets of practice that really need support, that may be because actually trying to understand what this innovative practice means in practice is really quite challenging, just even to take it on board. So to then say, and now we need further innovation based on cuts, when we've actually had quite substantive change in the way in our approach, I think I'm interested in reflections on actually if now the mandate is organised around the user, don't show your complexity as a series of silos of services. How actually do service providers get to grips with the reality of that? Does it mean that, what does collaboration really look like if you have services working across the piece together around the user? I'll start with you on that, Mark. Is that
super?
Just put you on the spot.
Well, I mean, I think the thing is that the mindset has changed. David used the word patchy. And I would say across the sector, it's extremely patchy. I would say even within my own organisation, some bits of it have grasped it better than others. And when we're talking about cuts, there are some places where I have services that have just had or are about to have 20, 25, 30% cuts, where, although it's painful in terms of people being employed and so forth, I am not scared about those places delivering a poor service to service users, because culturally, the staff are in the right place. The service is embedded, and it does make that connectivity with all sorts of, not just statutory agencies, but other bodies, community groups, small charities and so forth. I'm not worried about those places. I'm worried about places where that mindset and the understanding is not yet in place. But the thing is that people aren't... You can't not cut somewhere because they haven't quite got it, can you? It would be a perverse incentive for not moving on. So the worry for me is that it is difficult, and it does take some time for people to understand it. You need to see the reality of what's happening. If you've been doing something the same way for 20 years and someone says, you know what, that's rubbish, because it's not rubbish, it's just it's what we've been doing for maybe the last 20 years, an awful lot of the expense, probably not necessary. We were over-medicalising certain things. We were looking for formal psychosocial things to solve problems that actually they were not necessary. And for people, particularly people who are employed, to understand that things need to be done a different way is a challenge. As far as the connectivity thing, there was a fantastic statistic came to me the other day. We work in Manchester. We provide the opiate prescribing service in Manchester. So anything more clinical than that? But the manager of our service said, we're going to cut, and there's a re-tender, and hopefully we'll win that. But what are you going to do to make sure that your menu of options is as good as it is now? And she said, it's going to be better. She said, Did you know there are 5,500 charities registered at a Greater Manchester address? 5,500 charities. Now, this is a fairly forward-looking service of ours. It's probably the high double figures of charities that we work with. But the way that we're going to look at it is to have a menu of things, to use things that are out there that we don't actually have to pay for, to look to give our service users their right to engage with stuff in society, which they've every bit as much right to as we do. There are some stigma blockages that we need to get past and break those things down. And we do need to get people in a place where they're ready to engage with the mainstream services. You talked about DWP and so forth. But it's a cultural shift. It's a cultural shift in the workforce. Do you know what? The service users get it a lot quicker. They understand it right off the bat. Yeah, there's lots of stuff in my life that I'd like to be different. It's not just drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. If I can say it, I mean, I still find it frustrating that there are still people in our field who believe in magic dust. And sadly, many of them are academics who still try and come up with solutions of some pill or talking therapy that will make everything better. It's just unrealistic for a complex problem that resolves over time. So the first thing I think important to say is there are no magic solutions. There's no magic bullets here. The second thing I think is that there are some things that make it more challenging in some places. There are things about place that we know matter. So Rethink in 2008 said there are things that get you to the starting point of a recovery journey. There's good evidence for this. You need a safe place to live that's free from threat. You need to be of sufficient physical and psychological well-being to allow you to start a recovery journey, and you have to have choice, so it can't be a kind of mandated recovery process. So those are the three. So, you know, we know the places where there's terrible housing, where there's very low employment, where there's poor social cohesion. All of those things are negative recovery capital, not impossible. Where I think the system has failed much more strongly is we know a pretty good evidence base about what successful commissioning of recovery systems looks like. There is an evidence base around this, and most British commissioners appear to be entirely unaware of what it is. Now, you know, there are 5 or 6 really excellent system evidence bases about what works at a systemic level that haven't really been integrated or articulated well in a British context. And the last thing, and I think by far the most challenging thing, and Mark alluded to it, is there have been people who've been inspirational champions of change. And we've known this. We used the very clunky language of recovery champions in 2009, 2010. And most people who were them didn't want anything to do with that label, and entirely understandably. And there's a different language of community connectors. Now, they happen both at a service professional level and at community level. We haven't worked out, and I don't know if we ever will, how to mine them, how to reproduce them, to recreate them, to multiply them. And it's why some areas, why the Northwest in the 8 or 9 years ago kind of led the way, because they had several of those people. But those community connectors are a fundamental component of a successful recovery system. And in the UK and globally, identifying those people who are the inspiration, the source of hope, has been such an important thing to do. But obviously it's not something we can do by a kind of cloning process. So it seems to me there are some things we can know about how to make things better. There's systemic things that we should do much better. And we need to learn that treatment has a vital role, not for everybody, but a limited role. And workers also need to learn to let go. You know, at some point, their expertise is exceeded. And it's one of the massive challenges of the switch to a partnership model is to say, you know, the psychiatrist, bizarrely, doesn't have all the answers to that question. And lots of it's way beyond their training and scope. And likewise, it's a multimodal problem that takes a complex solution where the family and the friendship network, as time goes on, becomes much more important than any professional.
The resources, I think, are out there. It's whether or not we have the mindset, really, to understand how we can access them in a time-honoured fashion for the individual. One of the things I have to say is that within any sector, this one in particular, I think effective leadership and management can either make or break a system. however good the system may be. I think the commissioners have a tough job, because how do you commission a service or a range of services that will meet the full range of needs of an individual? So for me, it makes much more sense if there's also almost a segment of a contract which is free flow, which can, you know, shape and mould and be agile to meet the individual kind of need. I'll give you an example. Last year we worked with 364 different agencies, organisations, resources to meet individual need. So nobody can tell me that they're not out there. But the fact of the matter is we record that. We have data systems that we've put into place to actually feed back into the system to say, well, actually, this is the type of need that's been presented. And more importantly, it's achieving individual needs, meeting individual needs. So I think collaboration is hugely important if it's done right.
Okay, any questions from the audience? We have a gentleman in the front, lady here.
Thanks very much, Mike Trace from RAPT. Thanks for the presentations, hugely thought-provoking, and agreed with just about everything that's been said so far. All the speakers have talked about the importance of positive social networks for recovery, call it mutual aid, recovery support networks, whatever. We've been saying that for some years in the sector, and the starting point we had for saying that was an almost complete monopoly of that recovery support provision of the 12-step fellowships. Yeah. So over the years, we've talked about smart recovery, intuitive recovery, other structures that could provide the same thing outside of a 12-step framework. Where do the panelists think we are with those development of alternatives to 12-step fellowships, and is that a good thing?
I think it's a really interesting question. You know, I think the first thing I'd have to say is, at least we've got to the place where people aren't describing the 12-step fellowship as probably not for you, when they don't know what it is in the first place. You know, it's not for everybody. That's not our decision to make. Maybe it isn't for everybody. All those other options, they are really important. I think we're getting somewhere with those different things being given an equal gravity. The fellowship's got a massive head start, which is not it's not a bad thing. I think that the thing that I really fear most is that ways to recovery, the ways that people recover, that we don't break down into some kind of internecine Spanish Civil War situation where it's 12 steppers against CBTs, against medical modellers and all that kind of stuff, because that absolutely ridiculous, it's just an annoyance. It just gets in the way of doing things. In fact, I was at the NA European Convention last month, I think it was, and I was speaking to one of the NA world directors, and we decided a good phrase for someone like me, who works for a treatment provider and does a bunch of stuff, and someone like her, who comes from the fellowship, was, we're fellow travellers. We might find different routes to the same place, but we all want to end up in the same place. And I think the most important way for a diversity of support groups, whether they're through mutual aid or whether they're through people engaging with faith communities or other things, I think if everybody keeps an open mind and says, if that's what's going to get you there, that's grand. I think it is that open-mindedness and not trying to hold some position that says this is the only way, because you only need one person to do it another way to prove that it's not the only way. I actually think the fellowships have moved further on that than some service providers have. I had a very warm welcome at the NA convention, and I thought they were extremely open-minded. I'm not sure that everybody in the treatment provider sector, I know you are, obviously, but I don't think everybody in the treatment sector is as open-minded as the fellowships have become, and I think the other mutual aid, they're also very much in that place.
Hi, my name's Ruth Kennedy. I lead a team called the Public Office. We've just finished a piece of work looking at recovery in mental health in Essex, and very, very, very strong parallels to what you've all described, that the manner of work is based upon a wholly different set of beliefs and attitudes and then behaviours and practices in terms of, you know, seeking the long-term outcome for the people involved. And the thing that we're trying to do some tough thinking on is particularly with commissioners, obviously across health and local authority, because the system conditions, it seems to us, are wholly inimical to this way of both thinking and working. the success criteria are wrong, the practices and behaviours are wrong, the leadership isn't in place, and so on. And I'd love to hear a little bit more from you, if you'd like to say a bit more. You've sort of all implied a little bit about that. But if we want to see recovery at the heart of the way we work more fully, we need to change the system conditions. Otherwise, it's always going to be just sort of on the margins, competing for space and resource.
David, you're nodding vehemently. Would you like to respond?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important to start by saying, and it doesn't take an academic to say, it's difficult. Because one of the challenges, you know, if you're a commissioner commissioning recovery services, you have to come up with operationalizations, and those operationalizations are going to be tricky for people. So you quickly end up with those kind of things about, you know, so you end up potentially defining success in terms of don't go to jail or get a job or don't, or give so many clean drug and alcohol tests. And that is a definition of recovery, but it's a very narrow clinical definition of recovery. And you're almost forced down that road if you want to try and evaluate the effectiveness of recovery-oriented services. Now, I have to say, in America, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration have produced some fabulous guidance on culture change at a systems level about how to create recovery-oriented systems. And the mental health field, I think, has been better than our field in things like quality assurance guidance for mental health recovery services, not particularly in Britain, but in some other countries, has been very successful. And Australia, way ahead in the mental health area than in the alcohol and drug services system in terms of quality assuring. It seems to me that one of the massive challenges is to reconcile those kind of personalised community definitions of recovery. So one of the things I think is about measuring things like the positive strength things, to create operationalisations of things like effective connections, quality of life, a sense of well-being. Because in the mental health field, I think they had the debate 5 years ago, we're continuing to have about how recovery should be defined in terms of abstinence or controlled use or whatever of those terms you want to use, by effectively saying it's a personal journey that's much more importantly defined in your own subjective experience of reintegration and well-being and quality of life. Now, that's hard because from a Treasury point of view, it's difficult to justify those kind of definitions. And it's something we've agonised with for a long time, is that notion of saying I think you're much more likely to successfully commission recovery services if you move away from the individual of the unit of analysis. And it's also incidentally why I don't think randomised control trials are a good idea in this area. But effectively, if you start looking at broader community indicators of volunteering, engagement, well-being. Now, we published earlier this year the first UK Life and Recovery Survey, and what we found was that among people in long-term recovery, the rate of volunteering was 79.4%, and that's double the rate you get in the general public who have never had an addiction problem. And so you can look at, instead of just looking at those deficit and pathology measures, I think what commissioners should be measuring is effective community cohesion, engagement, and those broader public health and well-being indicators, not at the individual level, but at the ward or district level. I have no idea whether I answered the question or not, but I talked for a long time.
Just a tiny wee thing.
A tiny wee thing.
I am going to defend commissioners a little bit. You might expect me to. They give me a lot of money to do this, right? Not to defend them. But I've seen commissioners start to get things really quickly. We've got a lot of really decent commissioners. They are sort of forced to use some of the outcomes and measures they do. But the fantastic thing is, if you run a really good recovery-focused service, looking at the whole person and doing all that stuff, actually the indicators that they want do get better anyway. It's not, I've been called an unintended benefit, but it's almost a side effect of running a proper recovery service, that all those, you know, maybe slightly blunt instruments, they do get met anyway. So I would say it's not, I don't experience as much of a problem as some perhaps.
I think we're a bit scared of my timekeeping. Yeah.
And just really quickly, to add to that, it's not just about commissioners or the commissioning team, it's about people that sit behind and around those individuals. I think those are the people, the key people that we need to try and influence. And it's about feeding back intelligence that perhaps they're not expecting that fits into some of the other kind of city-wide or local authority-wide intentions.
Okay, gentlemen there, and I think that's going to have to be our last question.
Hello. Thanks for the presentations. Quick bit of context. I met Mark 7 years ago when I was in treatment, so I was... Sorry?
It was a perfectly reasonable service.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Just carefully.
Yeah. So I started off with service user. I sort of went through a journey a bit like Sunny, basically, from 2008 to now. I've started up Recovery Initiative Social Enterprise in Kingston, which is doing something similar to what you're doing. And I've had similar experiences with you as well, difficulties with the establishment, et cetera, et cetera. And then last year I presented with Dr. David Best at Chester University. So this is quite an interesting bit of context, really. Quick few points. After I left working with the service users and stuff with Mark, I started looking at a different way of doing stuff, basically, because I wasn't impressed with service users. It was a really good effort at the time and that sort of thing. But I went to a conference that David was presenting something, and I first grasped the potential of recovery, basically, and also therefore the potential of myself. All the learning I've done, and this is one of the points I want to make, was done in the north, basically. I couldn't find anything in London that influenced me in any way whatsoever. So I found stuff up in Scotland, and particularly Lancashire, Birmingham, pockets there, Cardiff, and I've sort of visited all these places and brought this to Kingston, basically, which is in London. And there was I can't find anything similar to that. But the problem is, geographically, no one understands this language. They don't respect this language. It's old hat, basically. When you go up to the north, there's a different language, basically. And I think that's a massive challenge for London, basically. It's very top-down. It won't allow recovery, basically. Point two is they don't access the massive assets, which are recovery communities. I've got a friend next to me here today, sort of thing. I mean, he might as well be my doctor, basically. He understands my recovery more than any professional would ever know. The power of recovery communities are huge. And they're sitting there now, and we don't access them, and we don't respect them. You know, the recovery community should be training the services and training commissioners, training people, basically, because they have the evidence live, you know. Finally, I get to my question sort of thing is, would you guys all come to Kingston to look at where we are, man? Because what we're trying to do is get evidence which is local, which is meaningful to the commissioners, basically, because it means to them economically, showing the social value and the economic value of what we're doing. We have Kingston University studying how our organisation actually does that, the social and economic value of what we're doing. We'd like to sort of marry it to what you're doing in a much wider sense, something to basically give us more credibility, but also to actually make some change around here, sort of thing, because we have all the evidence. We need to present it properly, effectively, and basically challenge the systems to say that this is the best way and it's the cheapest. Because the final point I'll make is all resources are there. All the resources are there. We've got no money, basically, but our organisation, I haven't been paid since July, but we've never been working so better than we are at the moment, because all the resources are free, basically, already exist.
So if I take that as a series of comments and an invitation rather than a single question to respond to, as we are out of time, and I invite you to connect and broaden the recovery community with our panellists today, and indeed with our whole person recovery team here at the RSA, and we have Jack and Susie in the audience today. So I think thickening connections is a very strong thing, that theme that has come up in this session. In terms of this panel, it has been very interesting here, and I think it has focused on thickening connections, connectivity, it's focused on culture change, and it has really, really majored on community. And all of those things are certainly things that we have found as very important research teams in our whole person recovery research project, which we will be producing the final report at the end of this month, so do look out on the RSA website for that. Please join me once again in thanking today's terrific speakers, Sunny Dadley, Mark Moody and David Best.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.